Welcome to Spies of London with Paul Detman. Okay, welcome to this episode. It's our new format that we introduced last week. We now have a book review every week, a shorter book review, the main piece, which could be 15 or 20 minutes, and some factoids like Steve Wright in the afternoon. If you are interested in guest hosting or providing a book review, and you have a USB microphone and some ability to get me an MP3, then get in touch. We would love to hear from you. Did you know that Portland spy Ethel G was released from prison after 9 years? She then married her co-conspirator Harry Horton, and they moved to Poole in Dorset, not far from Portland. Ethel died a year before Harry, in 1984. Our main segment this week is a look at some of the MI6 locations, the former homes of MI6, in central London. So this episode is a deep dive into some of the locations on my walk, specifically the Thames Walk, which goes from Pimlico and or, depending on the day, Vauxhall Cross, along the river to Thames House, which is where MI5 is. Quick look at the Home Office, along the Thames through to Broadway Buildings, number 54 Broadway, Ministry of Justice and beyond to the Foreign Office. Now, the big drawback with a physical walking tour, which I always found frustrating, is that you are restricted to a specific location, or at least within an hour's walk of a certain location, which means that it damages the chronology of the walk or the story or the theme that you're trying to develop. So on the Thames Walk, we have the current MI6 and the current MI5. We have the former MI6 in Broadway, but not Century House. And we can't cover the former MI5, which is Leconfield House, because that's on the Mayfair Walk, which is not where Broadway is. So one walk has a bit of MI5 and a bit of MI6. A different walk has a different bit of MI5 and a different bit of MI6. And it's just frustrating as somebody who wants to produce a nice narrative that takes you through the history of how these organisations have developed, and you can't. These restrictions do not apply to a virtual walk or the podcast. So there is a whole planning session going on for a set of virtual walks which you simply could not follow. They may even take in the CIA in Langley, Virginia, and they would look at the history of the organisation through its headquarters and offices, which I think is a fabulous way to do it. But it's not possible to walk that particular route. And it's not really that easy to walk the route that we're talking about today. So today it's MI6. To most intents and purposes, it started at 54 Broadway because that is the Cold War home of MI6. It's where John le Carré worked. By this stage, MI6 was a professional organisation, although obviously any organisation of that size could be improved upon. Broadway is in many respects everybody's home for MI6. Although John le Carré sets MI6, he calls it the circus and sets it in Cambridge Circus, which is in the West End. In his mind, the building that he's describing is Broadway. He just moves the location perhaps to protect it, because when MI6 was at Broadway, its existence and location were not known or published. And in fact, the plaque on the wall used to say Minimax Fire Extinguisher Company of Ruislip or something like that. I'm pretty sure it was Ruislip. Of course, Ruislip's famous for the Gordon Lonsdale episode as well. So today, Broadway is a normal office building with normal companies in there. It's been redeveloped and really made into quite a nice reception area. But the externals are the same. They've just been cleaned up and tidied up. But Broadway today is exactly how it was in John le Carré's time when MI6 was here. And perhaps Broadway has the strongest claim to MI6 because it was the headquarters from 1924 to 1966. So that covers the Second World War and the hottest part of the Cold War. But in many ways, I think your favourite MI6 building is a bit like your favourite James Bond. It tends to be whoever was current when you were a child or a teenager. So my James Bond is Roger Moore, but my MI6 headquarters is Century House in Lambeth. 100 Westminster Bridge Road, now some apartments apparently. Century House was where the spies were working when I was growing up. But I still think that Broadway is the official home because it covered a period when MI6 was becoming larger and more professional. However, there is a blue plaque on number 2 Whitehall Court, which was the HQ for only 10 years or so, 1911 to 1922. And it's where Mansfield Smith Cumming worked as one of the most famous heads of MI6, still referred to by the letter C. Perhaps for chief, perhaps for Cumming, perhaps for court. It could be anything. But Mansfield Smith Cumming lived in a house behind Broadway, and there's a suggestion that there's a tunnel between Broadway buildings and his house, or the basement of his house. And there is definitely a suggestion that meetings were held in that house in Queen Anne Square. So this shows you the limits of using Wikipedia for research, because it misses things. The Wikipedia article on MI6 buildings is very good, but it's not complete. And although it says that Whitehall Court was the headquarters until 1922, it then states that Broadway buildings became the headquarters in 1924. So you've got a period of up to 2 years there where they apparently had no headquarters at all, which seems unlikely to me. So my favourite stop on the walk, the Thames Walk, is Broadway Buildings. It's at the junction with St James's Park Tube, which is where many of the staff would have arrived to work every day. It's opposite the old Home Office, now the Ministry of Justice. It's around the corner from the Foreign Office. It's near St Ermin's Hotel, which is a lovely, classic, top London hotel, which was used by MI6 and SOE in, during and after the war. St Ermin's has a division bell so that MPs in the bar know when to go and vote in Parliament. This and around the corner is the new Scotland Yard, which is the old Scotland Yard because it's now been demolished and they've moved back close to Whitehall. So you had Scotland Yard, Broadway, St Ermin's, Foreign Office, Home Office, Parliament itself, Downing Street, all within a very short walk of each other. This is the absolute nexus of British government and the establishment. And Broadway, for me, will always be the true home of MI6. The office which I am certain, because I've asked people, the office which brought people onto this walk and made it my most successful walk was Vauxhall Cross. Vauxhall Cross is the glass and steel building which appears in all of the recent James Bond films, going back to Pierce Brosnan. It's the building which gets blown up as Judi Dench parks her car on the bridge and looks at it, and there's some kind of rocket or grenade goes off inside. Vauxhall Cross is the building which opened in 1994, which is when MI6 and MI5 were admitted publicly for the first time, and the Director Generals were published, or at least the names were published. So the one everybody wants to see, especially the foreign tourists, is Vauxhall Cross. And when you look at it across the river, perhaps from the bar in the Morpeth Arms, which has its own spying gallery with telescopes on the first floor, strongly recommended, by the way, or even when you look at it from the bridge, or from closer, perhaps coming out of Vauxhall Cross Station, it just looks impressive. It looks modern, even though it's getting on for 30 years old. It's imposing, perhaps a little bit communist, and the things on the roof, by the way, are not guns or rocket launchers. They are devices used for cleaning the windows. And there is a map of the South Bank outside the riverside apartments on the North Bank, so you can see across the river and plot your landmarks. That map is nicely done as a stencil on a metal plate, and it has the Tate Gallery there. It has lots of other things just out of your sight as well, famous landmarks from London that are just round the river or behind you. But it has a massive gap where MI6 is. So it seems amusing to me that 1994, the new Act of Parliament, the new building for MI6, everything's exciting, everything's transparent and open, and the developers of this park have made a map which explicitly and somewhat obviously excludes the building that everybody's there to see, MI6. And this is the building that brings people onto my walk. But it's the least interesting building in the whole of MI6's history. And I think partly that's because they now have a website, they have an address in the phone book, if there is a phone book anymore. We know who the Director General is. The mystique has gone. Yes, it's an exciting building, in a way that Thames House could never be, but the mystery has gone. And I think there's a lesson there for all of us who are involved in the kind of fun and entertaining side of Cold War history, is that the draw, the excitement around spying, is because of the secrecy. If you take away the secrecy, you take away the excitement. So although the American tourists really love to see MI6, they've seen it at the movies, it's nice to get a photo of MI6. Century House is not a good building. It was massively refurbished after MI6 left and became flats. But the name of it, the location, it's near the SOE Memorial. The fact that it was secret at the time that MI6 was based here all adds to the mystery. So the two buildings that I really focus on are Vauxhall Cross and Broadway. But I think Whitehall Court and Century House are far more exciting than Vauxhall Cross. So you could do a walk from Vauxhall Cross through the South Bank to Lambeth, Century House, Whitehall Court, Broadway, Foreign Office, and just do the MI6 buildings. But there was not enough in between each one to justify making people march around for that long. What we found was that no matter what the weather was doing, the Thames Path is windy and cold, even in July and August. So you have to be pretty determined to want to do this walk, the walk I'm suggesting, which takes in the former homes and the current home of MI6. If I was planning a walk today, I might start at the new American Embassy in Nine Elms, go to Vauxhall Cross, and then follow the river through the history of MI6. But the American Embassy was still in Grosvenor Square when I started doing this. And I also make the point on the walks that, you know, this is not a walk about buildings. The buildings are the stage, and what we are really talking about in this podcast and on the walks are the actors on the stage. And they really were actors in many cases. The people who were operating overseas were actors, no question. Very good actors who risked their lives in many cases. So although a walk takes place in a street which is lined with buildings, and I point at the buildings and say, isn't that amazing? Look at the former office of John le Carré. Look at the former office of Ian Fleming. Look at the current office of MI5, MI6. Imagine who is in there now. Imagine what stories are being told in there that will reach our ears 20, 30, 40 years from now. The stage is interesting, but it is not the story. And I keep reminding myself of this, because if you are having a difficult day, if you can't quite find the right story to engage the audience, there is a risk that you end up pointing at bricks and saying, look at that pile of bricks. That's not what this walk is about. It's not what this podcast is about. And my next question to you is, you know, how long do you think MI6 will remain at Vauxhall Cross as intelligence work changes again since that building was opened? It becomes more electronic. A lot of the work has now moved to GCHQ. The emphasis has moved to GCHQ in Cheltenham, one of the few spy agencies that has never had a proper home in London. We did learn sometime after my last walk that GCHQ did have a secret office in Palmer Street, which is near St Ermin's and Broadway buildings. That surprised everybody because they have this state-of-the-art circular building buried into a hillside in Cheltenham, which reminds me of the Apple headquarters. They actually carried on having this office in Palmer Street until very, very recently. It's only just been closed. And the only giveaway is the regulation government bollards which protect from vehicle attack. Are there offices we don't know about? Possibly. When will MI6 move again? When it outgrows the current building? Will they buy the building next door? Will they dig down? Will they have a second building, perhaps in the north of England, perhaps overseas? All of these are possible. And I always try to look at forwards as much as I look backwards. There is a risk with Cold War history. Because the past is known much better, because the files have been opened, the people have died in some cases, people are getting older and want to tell their story. We're still learning. There's a new book out now about Gordon Lonsdale. We're still learning about the 60s and 70s. What do we not know? What is happening today in those buildings, which we will learn about in 2050? It is very exciting. And I do like looking at the buildings. I like to imagine what's going on inside. But it's important to remember that the buildings are not the story, and it's not buildings that excited Ian Fleming. Our final factoid about Gordon Lonsdale. He lived with the Krogers in a Ruislip bungalow, a short walk from RAF Northolt, which is the same runway used to spirit him back to Russia when he was exchanged for Greville Wynne. And on that bombshell, I hand over to Paul for his look at Ian Fleming, The Man Behind James Bond, by Andrew Lycett. Thanks, Paul. So we have this week's book review section, which is, as advertised, Ian Fleming by Andrew Lycett. Andrew Lycett was educated at Christ Church, Oxford, and has been a foreign correspondent in Asia, the Middle East and Africa. Now based in London, he is a regular writer for The Times, contributor to The New York Times and other international publications. His most recent book was Gaddafi and the Libyan Revolution. So an establishment figure there, Andrew Lycett, and that's okay. We like establishment figures. Any suggestion that I don't like establishment figures is simply because I'm from Yorkshire. So, Andrew Lycett wrote this book in 1995. So, right in the period we've just been talking about, which was the opening of MI6 at Vauxhall Cross in 94. Apparently, the end of the Cold War, but people like John le Carré, who knows what he's talking about, didn't think it was the end of the Cold War. What better time, the 90s, to look back at the life of Ian Fleming, who died before his time, and lives on today through the films, many of which, or most of which, were not based on his books. There were simply not enough books to supply Hollywood with this many films. But the newer films do reflect the ethos and the life of Ian Fleming where they can. So the film GoldenEye is named after Fleming's house in Jamaica, GoldenEye, which in turn was named after Operation GoldenEye, which is mentioned extensively in this book, a Second World War era contingency plan developed in case the Nazis invaded Gibraltar. And there are other books about Fleming's commandos and Gibraltar by people like Nicholas Rankin, which you can also read and are absolutely fabulous. Interestingly, I didn't know this, Bob Marley bought GoldenEye after Fleming's death, and then Chris Blackwell of Island Records bought it. What I find in this podcast, in this research, is every fact you find leads you to about 10 others. Many of my spy friends in the UK are massive Fleming fans, and I was never a massive Fleming fan. I only recently read his books, and the first couple, you know, Casino Royale, was it Live and Let Die, Man with the Golden Gun. I read a couple of the early ones and thought, yeah, these are great. Fabulous stories, great plots, easy to read, not too long. Fabulous. They help you to understand James Bond as Ian Fleming saw him, which is not how many of the actors and producers see him, I have to say. In the same way that Alec Guinness wasn't George Smiley, but he kind of was. Roger Moore is definitely not James Bond. Possibly Daniel Craig gets closest, but maybe it's too soon to tell. The point is that James Bond is significantly more famous than Ian Fleming. You can't say that about George Smiley. Although you might have seen the Smiley film, you might have seen the Smiley show, you might have read the Smiley books, he isn't the hero. The hero, if anything, is the secrecy and the story and the way the characters work against each other. Whereas James Bond is definitely the hero. He's outgrown Ian Fleming. He's outlived Ian Fleming, sadly. But I have an interesting observation to make here. Apart from the fact this book is brilliant, I was interested doing my recent research on a side project about Patrick Leigh Fermor, the famous kidnapper of the general on Crete in the Second World War. Patrick Leigh Fermor became a writer, in fact was a writer before the war, and got involved in SOE, and had this crazy plan to abduct a German general, which was successful. Patrick Leigh Fermor was a friend of Anne Fleming, and knew Ian Fleming before and during the writing of Casino Royale, the first book. I have previously, and I am about to repeat this claim, stated that Patrick Leigh Fermor is one of the people Ian Fleming had in mind when he created James Bond. The reason I say this, beyond what I've just said, is that one of Patrick Leigh Fermor's books is referenced in a Bond novel, and I will leave it to the listener to determine which book, which novel, and all the rest of it, and I will tell you next time. So looking more closely at Lycett's book, and this was recommended to me by a friend, the publisher's claiming that this was the definitive biography of Ian Fleming, and I am not in a position to argue with that. You can see his relationship developing with Anne O'Neill, who became Anne Fleming, the Lady Anne, and then you wonder whether the Lady Anne Fleming had any relation to the Lady Anne Smiley, who was George Smiley's wife, and you come to the conclusion that they are the same person. And then you see again just how overlapping the world of fiction is with real-life espionage. So, we have Fleming's relationship with Anne O'Neill, we have GoldenEye, the operation he was involved with in the Second World War. This relationship continued for 15 years, ending in marriage only after she became pregnant a second time. 2 months before the wedding, to soothe his frayed nerves, Fleming sat down to write Casino Royale. So began the long line of Bond novels, which in this volume are given their fullest publishing history. So this is a book which is supposed to be about Ian Fleming, which is really about James Bond. Fleming died in August 1964 at the age of 56. And it's a tragedy for everybody who likes James Bond and the films and the books that Fleming didn't get to write more of them. Of course, he has been brought back from the dead by people like Anthony Horowitz. There are new Fleming novels written as Ian Fleming in the style of Ian Fleming, just as there are new Bond stories in the films. And I don't mind that. The Anthony Horowitz book in particular is very good. I understand the brand. I understand how powerful a writer's voice can be. You can imagine years from now somebody writing as J.K. Rowling or, you know, any of the top writing as J.R.R. Tolkien has never been done as far as I know, but it could be. And it shows how powerful the brand, the logo, the idea of a writer is, way beyond the writer themselves. It's harder now, but in the 60s and earlier than that, the writer really was just a name. they didn't go on Twitter all the time. They weren't on the radio and TV all the time. There wasn't that gravy train of that platform of marketing that goes into a book now. So to many people, Ian Fleming was just a name. Therefore, there is no reason why that name cannot continue. I do not have an issue with that. I know some people do. But what you find, what I find, when you learn about writers more and you learn about their past and their present and their lives, is sometimes you like them a little bit less, just a little bit, because, and it takes one to know one, writers are not the nicest people to know. Ian Fleming seems to have been unusual in the sense that he liked the parties as much as he liked the writing, and he liked the secrecy as much as he liked the promotion. But generally, writers are obsessive, introverted, headstrong, stubborn. You have to be to finish a book, never mind 20 books or 30 books. And the more I get to know writers, all writers, even John le Carré, Ian Fleming, whoever, the more you realise that perhaps they weren't the easiest people to live with. And that is a risk that you take on when you read a biography like this. Now, I have a distance from Ian Fleming because I'm not a massive to the death Bond fan, although I do appreciate the books and the films. There is a risk if you are a nailed-on Bond fan that you will think less of Ian Fleming after this book. But that's a very small part of the story. The major part for me, the really eye-opening and exciting thing, is that Ian Fleming was every bit the spy that James Bond became. Now, he did work in the background very often, but not always. He was in danger. There was an episode when they got shot at in a ship and nearly sunk and nearly killed, and it was sheer fluke that they all survived. But generally, he was a backroom operator. So Ian Fleming was much more, as I see it, like George Smiley in the shadows, putting out ideas for operations, planning them, but not carrying them out. But there were elements in his past in the Second World War when he did put himself in danger. Ian Fleming was a wartime hero. He is a great writer, and he should have had the chance to write more books. Andrew Lycett's done a really good job. There's some nice photos in the middle. You can hopefully hear me flicking through it right now. I still have it here. I actually own this copy. And yes, he had aspects of his private life which were challenging and difficult. But there's a picture of him here at GoldenEye with the Lady Anne, Cecil Beaton, Noel Coward and unnamed friends. He knew Patrick Leigh Fermor. He was the John le Carré of his day. And you have to wonder, as I have before, in the same way that, say, Patrick O'Brien was the replacement for the guy who wrote Hornblower, was John le Carré the replacement for Ian Fleming? Well, no. There is a coincidence in the timings. So John le Carré's career was just starting to take off when Ian Fleming died. But you cannot compare the John le Carré books, which are very strongly character-led, introspective books about mentally challenging, intellectually challenging ideas, with James Bond, who is a gun-toting, license to kill, ladies' man, party-goer. Whichever Bond you look at, there are women, guns and alcohol. So no, le Carré was not the replacement for Ian Fleming. That was a coincidence. But perhaps his publishers hoped for a little bit more plot and a little bit less character from John. We don't know. You can even get this first edition hardback for not very much money. I think this one's unread. Borrow, buy or steal, Ian Fleming by Andrew Lycett, the man behind James Bond. This is equally about James Bond himself. And I really enjoyed it. Okay, thanks, Paul. It does ramble a bit at the end there, but I think you got the message that he liked the book. Okay, so coming next time, we have a special book for you. It's called The New Spies by James Adams, and it was written in the early 90s when MI6 became public knowledge, and it's looking at the future of espionage. So I acquired this book when it came out in the early 90s, and I've just found it on the shelf, and I'm dying to see how accurate James Adams was, given everything that's happened in the last 30 years, when he looked forwards from the early 90s to the present time. So that's coming next time, The New Spies by James Adams, if you fancy reading it ahead of us. Thanks so much for listening. We do appreciate you listening. We do appreciate the reviews. However you listen to your podcasts, there is usually a way to star it or review it in some way, and those reviews are read by me. They do help us. Please do get in touch if you want to provide feedback. Spies of London will return